Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, as a new exhibition puts women artists in the spotlight, we ask why they're being underrepresented. It's been closed for 80 years, but now a North London theatre is about to welcome the public again. And later we'll find out more. Also ahead...
We have capitalism has been globalized, but the rules that protect people from the abuses of capitalism have not been. So we have minimum wages in rich nations, but we don't have a global minimum wage that prevents abuses around the system.
Jason Hickel on how we can beat poverty. We'll take a look through the weekend's papers. Plus...
Really happy to be in the Television Centre. It's an iconic building in London and abroad, so it's a great project. It's going to be, hopefully, a new centre of gravity for West London.
That's how we'll find out how one London restaurant is expanding. All that ahead in the next hour on Sunday Brunch, live from London on Monocle 24. So good morning from the studio here in London. Not the warmest start to the day. And not the usual start to the day. There's actually a newspaper today that doesn't have Brexit on the front page, which is slightly out of the ordinary for a Sunday. The Sunday Times, however, says that it's now war between Boris Johnson and Theresa May, which is odd because they've been getting on so well beforehand. And we'll talk more about that when we go through the weekend's newspapers in about half an hour's time. But first today... Two-thirds of postgraduate art students in London last year were women. In which case, why is it that women only make up one-third of the artists represented by the city's major galleries? And perhaps more importantly, what is being done and what can be done to redress that imbalance? Well, a new exhibition is opening in London of work by British female artists. It is called 21st Century Women, and its curators are with me in the studio now, Fru Throlstrup and Jane Neal. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
To begin with, Fru, tell me a little bit about the exhibition.
Well, the exhibition is predominantly an exhibition with British artists. We have 18 artists. It's a celebration of the centenary of the emancipation, which is a very, very important factor that has been going on for some time. There are many different artists, are there not, Jane, who...
Yeah, I mean, the exhibition, we wanted to do something to mark, obviously, the centenary of women getting the right to vote in Britain, or starting to get the right. Obviously, not all women were awarded it in 1918. But also an exhibition that reflected the talent, the diversity and breadth of talented women working today in Britain, and to celebrate their practices. Some of the women in the show have chosen to make work that's politically motivated, falls into the territory of body politics. We can talk about that in a moment. And some of the women have chosen to make work that's not read through the lens of their sex, but is actually about the work that they want to make. And we wanted to celebrate this. So we put together this exhibition, which does that.
And it's a mix, isn't it, of established artists and emerging ones?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Fru, I think you can sort of say a little bit more about, you know, I mean, obviously we have some key figures in there.
We have some key figures. Obviously, we have some, you know, very well-known artists. Just to give you a little idea, Jenny Saville, who is probably one of the most important British artists working today. But we also wanted to really mix that up and get in some sort of, you know, not as well-known artists, just to sort of get a really good sort of, you know, across view. So we have Zoe Buckman, who is an artist who is she was born in Hackney. She's now, she's a very sort of strong feminist artist. She's living in New York, but she's made us these incredible works, which we're going to have in the show as well. We have other well-known artists called Sue Webster, Maggie Hambling. We have some very young artists as well, and we wanted to give them an opportunity to show against, you know, alongside a lot of these very, you know, more sort of well-known artists, just to give a different sort of cross-section of it all.
You mentioned a moment ago some of the topics that are explored in this. Tell us a little more about that.
Okay, so I think for us it was very important. Obviously, we have a show that's cohesive, that it's reflecting different artist practices, and so we've got work that ranges from installation, sculpture, and painting, photography. But we looked at certain themes. So we've got themes such as women and power, and also sexuality and gender. gender, but also portraiture, and then looking at sort of more kind of, let's say, abstracted, loose sort of sections such as fairy tales, image and mysticism, and nature and the sublime. So really a great broad range of works. And for us, it was very important that we could bring together a group of artists who had taking on different sort of challenges. So Frew's already mentioned Jenny Saville, who makes these paintings of gargantuan, sort of fleshy women, which really confronts this sort of very strong kind of media stereotype of the only acceptable image of a woman being quite airbrushed, young, lithe, beautiful. And looking at different ideas around beauty and the body, and also the idea of the body as a site, which is constantly under transformation, according to a lot of the pressure on women today.
We mentioned those figures at the start of the program that 2/3 of the art students are female, but only 1/3 of the artists are being represented by the major galleries. That implies either that women are really struggling to get noticed at the start of their careers, or that they're actually just giving up at quite an early stage.
I mean, my personal feeling is that something happens to women, usually around the age of 30, past 30, we start to see a dropping off point quite dramatically, and fewer women in the really big, you know, blue chip galleries actually still presented. Auctionally, we should look at auction results too. I mean, there's still quite a massive discrepancy in terms of the price points of male and female artists. So as you said, the question is why? I mean, Frew, what do you think? I mean, I think I have my own...
I think, you know, I think what's also, you know, very important to think and look at here is these big institutions. You know, when we look at the figures for Tate, just to give you a little idea here, Tate's got 30% cap on the collection of female artists. Not only that, but they literally, you know, part of their budget is 13%, which is spent on, you know, female artists. So, you know, that's incredibly, incredibly small. Mm-hmm. And if these are these are the figures that are for big institutions, then what are the general public thinking?
So
a 30% cap. So it only displays 30% or only holds 30% as a matter
on the collection
of policy.
Yeah. So only 30% of all artists are female in the Tate. And in fact, you know, 13% of their annual budget is spent on female artists, which is quite shocking.
I mean, on the one hand, we've already talked about in some of the art that's been chosen for this exhibition, some of the things that the artists want to say, which will be specifically because they are women. But equally, at the same time, there's an argument that it shouldn't actually matter, particularly you talked about the auction market.
Yeah.
It shouldn't make the blindest bit of notice whether it was a man or a woman.
No, it shouldn't. And I think it's interesting because I've had conversations, and I'm sure Frew has too, with certain gallery directors, you know, big ones, who have said, well, we've got one of those. We've already got a woman artist who does that painting. So the fact that they're even picked out like that, I think, in today's world, is still very shocking. Things have been said such as, you can tell that it was a woman making that work because it's somehow softer. I mean, the arguments that you would never get away with in, I think, other forms of, you know, different practices and different, you know, backgrounds. So I think it's quite astounding. I would argue that for the most part, you know, there isn't a direct sort of application of misogyny or kind of a direct move against women. Nonetheless, I think the system works in such a way that maybe it's because the environments that women are going into are predominantly male, perhaps that there is a latent misogyny, we could argue, that I think a lot of women find it quite intimidating. It's still quite tough. And there's still an argument that if you make the work or your program too female, that you might put off some of your more established collectors for some of the commercial galleries, which
I'm obviously very naive here, but you would have thought that if there were a community in which this would have been less of an issue, it might have been the artistic community.
But it could have been quite different. And I think also what we have to look at is the fact that a lot of these sort of later in life female artists have become incredibly popular. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, Louise Bourgeois at the end of her life, you know, she really was an important artist. And I think a lot of that could be something to do with the fact that, you know, these artists later on in their career, you know, when they've got, you know, sort of decades of their oeuvre, perhaps are, you know, sexually, you know, less powerful at this point. Maybe these women, you know, later on in their career, they're not so much of a threat. I mean, I always think that possibly has something to do with it. Why the younger artists struggle.
I think that could be. I mean, this is another reason why we wanted to do this show now. So this exhibition opens at the Unit London on the 4th of October and runs to the 3rd of November. And we are doing the show with a very young gallery. I mean, the guys that run the gallery, Joe Kennedy and Johnny Burt, are in their late 20s and actually looking to take on some female artists into their programme. And we just thought this was a great opportunity to work with a gallery which is very young in its outlook, very ambitious, but also reaching out to a younger audience. A lot of the people that come through their doors are in their 20s. And so we thought this was a great opportunity for us as quite seasoned curators to actually come together with a different sort of demographic as well. Yeah. And hopefully make some changes.
Johnny, you know, they both came to us and said, we want a female show, which I think was actually quite brave in a way. And, you know, they are incredibly media savvy. And I think we've had amazing response to the show already.
Well, let's try and find some other positives, though. What can be done? Going back to those statistics about the proportions, what is it? Is it about mentoring? Is it about having quotas that go beyond 30%?
Well, both of those things for sure. I mean, in terms of mentoring, I think if a younger female artist has some role models to look at, people say, look, you know, don't be intimidated, for example, by, you know, an artist today has to have a good business knowledge as well and understand how the world works. The wonderful thing about the art market is it's free. You know, it's one of the few unregulated markets out there. But because of that, it's very difficult sometimes to get a handle on how it actually works. How the whole system works, how one can progress as an artist. And I still feel, unfortunately, that a number of women are too nervous of looking stupid or of putting themselves forwards and fear of getting things wrong. And I think that needs to be challenged. I mean, I think there are books out there being written by powerful women, such as It's a Good Time to Be a Girl, and this whole notion of confidence in the confidence code. And I think for women, it's like examining how we engage and not being so fearful is a good thing. So I think mentorship could be something. And Fru, what do you think in terms of statistics, in terms of, you know, this cap?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, things are moving forward. We've got a long way to go, I think, and we all know. And I mean, the Times just had a big, big article, the FT, this weekend. And it was very, very clear to see that this amazing freeze that we're about to just embark on. You know, I think the title was, you know, a feminized art fair, which we haven't really heard that before. Half of the artists are women, which are in the Frieze Sculpture Park in Regent's Park, which I think is quite interesting because we've never had that many women. Mm. There are going to be a lot of women-only presentations, and also thinking about these institutions which are now led by women. You know, you look at Tate, and the two, you know, most important figures there are both women. So they really will have an opportunity to guide and help and mentor and change these stats.
I think it's changing. I mean, one thing that's quite noticeable is there are a number of women, quite a high percentage of women actually, in positions of power within the art world. Let's say behind the scenes or leading from the front in the galleries. It's just actually in terms of the artists themselves that there is this discrepancy in terms of balance. So it's, I would imagine that, as Frizz just said, you know, when you have these key figures in positions of power, that this should affect change in the gallery system. Maybe it's just a question of time, but I do think mentorship, and I think actually, you know, making it sort of coming from a more positive angle rather than a negative one and saying, come on, get out there. People want to see your work, and we shouldn't be so, I think, still carrying that 19th century kind of idea in our heads almost that it's the male artist and the female model. You know, we need to change that around.
And it sounds a bit like some of this needs to be in the art schools too, that it feels like from those statistics that you are losing at an early stage people who could have had a very productive and significant lifelong career who are choosing not to carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I went to art school. I went to the Ruskin, and when it was a small school, but when I was there, I'd say that women were generally pretty confident, but there's still this system where predominantly it's you have this image in your mind of the male artist and the female muse. And I think it's almost that, the psychology of that perhaps we need to examine. But I would also argue that you know, it might always come back to Mary Wollstonecraft, you know, the sort of celebrated foremother of feminism and the mother of Mary Shelley. And finally, there's going to be a statue made of her by Maggie Hamlin. Maggie's actually one of the artists in our show. And she always argued that for her, you know, writing back in the around the time of the French Revolution. You know, she was an extraordinary woman. And she said, you know, it's not about women having power over men, it's about having power over themselves.
Exactly.
And I think that's kind of, she was fed into this show, really, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, it's tough out there being an artist. And I mean, I think, you know, whether you're male or female, it is incredibly, incredibly tough world. And, you know, whether you're a successful artist or not, that's the other thing. I mean, can you actually make a living out of it? That's a very different thing to being an art student, to suddenly having a solo show in London, of which, you know, as we know, there's only about a third that could actually even get to that point. Mm. So it's tough. And, you know, women have to, you know, they're multitaskers as well. I mean, they might be looking after the kids, they might be doing all of that. Whereas in the male world, you know, it's absolutely standard that they get up in the morning and they go to work. But, you know.
Yeah, I think it's a question of the ego too. And I think of that question of the freedom to actually make the work you want to make rather than feeling that you're torn in lots of different directions. You know, you need to have a big ego to be an artist. You need to be able to look yourself in the eye and in the mirror every day and go, I can do this. People will want to see this work. You know, it's a form of communication at the end of the day. Mm. So I think it is about confidence and encouragement.
Well, so the exhibition opens on the 4th of October till the 2nd of November. It's at a unit in Mayfair in London. Fruth Rostrup, Jane Neal, thank you both very much for coming in this
morning.
Thank
you so much.
In just a moment, we'll be discussing the reopening of a theatre that's been closed to the public for the best part of a century. Stay with us.
Tune in to the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24, weekdays at 2200 London time. We unpack the stories that have been dominating the discussion in Europe and North America and set the agenda for a new day in Asia. The show features regular insights and analysis from Monocle's bureau in Toronto and New York, special guests there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London. Whether it's industry-focused reports on anything from art and architecture to business and entertainment, or a light-hearted guide to how to spend the perfect weekend in a great city somewhere in the world, you're in good hands. Monocle's network of global correspondents are your guides. Join our team every weekday for the Monocle Daily on Monocle 24.
Curtains up. Premiering in Monocle's October issue is our very first culture preview. From big box film releases to the art market's latest moves, we guide you through all you need to watch, see and read this autumn. On our global tour, we take a peek into Helsinki's newest museum to find out how Finland's art scene is stepping up its game and consider the future of Nordic noir. Is the Scandi bubble about to burst? Not to mention more finds from Switzerland to Taiwan. In our fashion pages, our biannual Top 50 will deliver all the scarves, coats and knits you need to keep cosy and suitably sharp. Autumnal breeze or not, Tom Ford isn't afraid to bear it all. We hear from the American designer on why it's the perfect time to launch a line of underwear. We sit down with Iceland's Prime Minister to find out how the left-wing environmentalist thawed her countrymen's suspicion of politicians and get a few tips from developers and retailers making the high street worth celebrating. Plus, we meet the architects rethinking our homes for a more sustainable future. The Monocle October issue is out now on all good newsstands. Do get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Well, next we're going to talk about London's oldest new theatre, as it were, which is reopening later this year, having been closed to the public for more than 80 years. It is the Alexandra Palace Theatre in North London, which sits in a building which is perhaps best known to many as the original home of television. The building is reopening, the theatre is reopening, after a three-year restoration project. Here to tell me more about it is the Deputy Chief Executive of the Alexandra Palace, Emma Dagnis. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
This morning. 80 years. Why did the theatre close 80-odd years ago?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Alexandra Palace has always had a slightly problematic journey, mainly due to being such a large building. And the theatre was used as a music hall, and at one point Gracie Fields actually used it for her rehearsals. But the management at the time found it quite difficult to actually make it commercially viable. And so when the palace was actually transferred into public ownership, there wasn't simply the funds to restore such a vast space. And it really is quite large. I mean, the capacity will be 1,300 standard and seating. And it's also got a very unique design underneath the theatre stage, because it's original Victorian wooden machinery, one of the last exemplars of its kind in the country. And so it wasn't just as easy as just saying, oh, we'll just put some paint somewhere and open the doors. It's been a very complex and intrinsic restoration project over the last 3 years.
Now, for those who don't know the building, tell us a little bit about its history.
Right. Well, it was built by the Victorians as a place of spectacle and wonder. So it was never actually a royal palace. It was a palace for the people. It opened in 1873, but then actually burnt down 16 days later, unbelievably. And in their sort of true Victorian entrepreneurship, they built it again, even larger the second time round. And it took them 2 years. It was very popular at the start of its journey. And in the 1980s, sadly, we lost a significant part of the building a second time to fire. And the restoration project from there took several years, and it reopened in the 80s.
Now, what it's probably, as I said a moment ago, best known for to a lot of people is it was from Alexandra Palace that the world's first TV service was broadcast.
Yes, that's right. So the BBC in 1935 actually leased the whole of the East Wing, including the theatre, interestingly enough. So the story goes that Daleks used to line the theatre corridor. And we had two studios, Studio A, Studio B, EMR Marconi system and the John Logie Baird system. And there was this incredible arms race of technology to see who was going to come forward. And the Emmetron camera actually won the day with EMI Marconi, led by Sir Isaac Schoenberg, who was this extraordinary character and a real leader and collaborative person and individual. And so the first television service broadcast by the BBC in the world happened from Alexandra Palace on the 2nd of November 1936.
In the midst of this three-year project, as you say, it's quite a complicated thing to do, and there was lots that you had to work around of what was there. What were the challenges that sort of, as you went through the 3 years, something that sort of pops up and you think, oh right, how are we going to deal with that?
Well, I mean, one of the most significant challenges we faced was when we actually lifted the floor. The floor was supported by Victorian dwarf walls, which look very beautiful, but on further investigation actually transpired couldn't take any weight whatsoever. So that was a significant project that we then had to adjust our thinking on. We had to involve the Theatres Trust, Historic England, to get permissions, and obviously the local conservation officers, to get permission to actually remove the majority of those dwarf walls, leaving one retained for interpretation, but then actually build breeze box underneath that could take the weight of a modern performance. Because one of the interesting points of this project is that we've really tried to bring the auditorium back to life. So most of the performances will be actually in the auditorium rather than on the stage house, simply because of the restrictions the stage house has with waiting. I think we used about 10,000 breeze blocks under there to get that kind of level of strength. And then we also actually replaced all the original Victorian wooden floorboards exactly where they were. So we picked them up, numbered them, cleaned them, and then put them back. And now the floor actually is 5 metres higher than it was when we started, because it started on a rake. So it's a really intimate space now.
Now, Alexandra Palace is already a concert venue. It already hosts sports events and all sorts of other things. Where do you see a theatre fitting in?
Well, what the Heritage Lottery Fund and the grant from the local authority have allowed us to do is to really bring life back to a space that was lost to the public. And with that, we've been able to develop this really phenomenal creative learning programme, which now means that because of the theatre and because of what the East Court will allow us to do, which is a 1,700 square metre space covered with Georgian wired glass, we're now able to go out into our community and tell this fabulous story of Alexandra Palace and this sort of tapestry of narratives that we have, including things like our sensory suitcase that we take into local care homes to build a closer relationship between a carer and their charge. And we also take it into local schools. And we do a lot of work with the Alzheimer's Society with Singing for the Brain at Alexandra Palace. And I think for me personally, one of the projects that has really showed what a transformation like this can achieve is that certainly with local people, Alexandra Palace has sort of been a constant in their life. You know, this 7-acre building sitting in 197 acres of parkland, and it's actually unlocked memories for people that haven't had those memories in over a decade.
I know you've put together a programme for when the theatre opens. I suppose one of the differences between now and the last time it was open is that there's an infinite number of ways that people can entertain themselves at home. And the first battle, as compared to, say, the 1920s, is actually persuading people to leave their home and come out for the evening.
Well, I think what's extraordinary with Alexandra Palace is, you know, we genuinely don't see necessarily that as an impact. We are a 10,000 capacity venue. Most of our shows sell out. I think that people still want to have that feeling of being with others, enjoying entertainment. But also there is something still about, you know, actually getting together with your friends and family outside of your home. But we're also recognising that trends are changing, and we have just gone into partnership with Melody VR, so you now will be able to sit at home and enjoy potentially a sold-out concert at Alexandra Palace on your VR headset in your living room, should you choose to do so. And I think, you know, for us, Alexandra Palace has always been at the forefront of technology, whether it was the technology under the theatre stage or whether it was the BBC broadcasting from Alexandra Palace on the East Wing. So we recognise that we need to reflect the pioneers of our past and be there at the forefront still today.
And when does the theatre reopen to the public?
So the first opening is the 1st of December, and we are having a 3-weekend-long Christmas carnival with lots of activities for the family to come up and enjoy. And then we go into a more formal programme with Horrible Histories, In Conversation with Gilbert and George. We've got Ronnie Scott's coming for 2 nights. So there's lots for everybody to enjoy.
Okay, Emma, thank you very much for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Well, time now for our weekend read. This week it's the anthropologist and author Jason Hickel, whose book is called The Divide, A Brief Guide to Global Inequality and Its Solutions. It talks about the true state of poverty, about where it comes from and what can be done about it, as Jason explained when he talked to Emma Nelson.
The dominant narrative that we have is that poverty is kind of a natural feature of the world, and a few rich countries manage to kind of escape poverty through their own kind of genius and their scientific inventions and their hard work. And so this is kind of the dominant story that we tell ourselves to explain why some countries have managed to become very wealthy while the rest of the world has kind of, quote, remained behind. But I challenge this view by pointing out that, in fact, the fate of rich countries and poor countries are tied into a single global economic system, whereby the process of accumulation in a handful of rich nations has actually been the cause of the impoverishment of much of the global south.
Therefore, so you have the sort of those who have and those who have not. And you say that actually you can divide this up geographically.
Yeah, so basically the book draws on a long tradition of what we call world systems theory, which sees the world is kind of divided into a kind of core of a few Western nations, Western Europe, Japan, the United States, versus what they call a periphery, which is the vast majority of the rest of the world, including sub-Saharan Africa, the developing nations of Latin America, South Asia, and so on. So, and the idea is that over the past 500 years, this system has been constructed in such a way as to extract value, wealth, and resources and labor from the periphery of the world system and feed it into the core, which explains sort of the proliferation of global inequality that we have today.
Is that something that is just naturally part of human nature, that we want to do as well as we can, and whether that means treading on our neighbor, well, that's just the way it is?
I guess that's not the way that I see it. I think that historically, I mean, I think that some nations have been more inclined towards conquest and imperialism than others, and that's certainly true of Western Europe and the US, I would say, for sure.
So it is in fact a mindset that we've actually built for ourselves.
That's the way that I see it. I mean, you could also just see it as a kind of consequence of real politic, you know, nations trying to get ahead, trying to build their states at the expense of other states and so on. And that's clearly also been at play here.
When you're putting this book together, I mean, many books have been written about the way that the world is structured economically and who takes advantage and who loses out. What was it that surprised you most in your research?
I guess the first really surprising conclusion that I was able to draw was that the dominant narrative that we have about global poverty is actually basically quite backwards, and it's built on very shaky foundations. So if you listen to people like Bill Gates and Steve Pinker, then the narrative that they purvey is basically one that where global poverty has been radically decreasing over the past couple of decades and is hopefully soon to be eradicated, hopefully by 2030 is kind of the narrative. But the only way that story works really is by relying on an extremely low international poverty line of a dollar a day. And, you know, that sounds normal to us because we hear it all of the time. But in fact, there's really a strong scholarly consensus that this poverty line is much too low to be adequate for basic human subsistence. And scholars,
so basically, we've got it wrong about what poverty means and actually what you basically need to do to lift us out of it.
Exactly. Yeah. As long as you rely on the dollar a day line, then you're looking at an extremely meager line for subsistence. And scholars' consensus is that we need to really measure poverty at closer to something like $5 a day, which is the minimum necessary for normal human life expectancy, for basic nutrition, for infant mortality rates to be a little bit lower, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens if you measure poverty at that level is you see that not only has poverty not been decreasing, it's been increasing since the 1980s quite dramatically, is now beginning to plateau off at about 4.3 billion people living below that line, which is 60% of the world's population. And so I use this data to show that, in fact, we have to understand that the global economic system we have right now is fundamentally not working for the vast majority of humanity, and this requires us to rethink how it operates.
Well, you in this one very neat paragraph, you sort of say, right, this is how we get rid of it. We get rid of the debt burdens of countries which are at the receiving end of them. We look at the things like making sure that there's a redistribution of wealth, there's fair wages, which allows people to grow themselves. Public services need to be good. You need access to wealth. Now, that's brilliant, but that requires people who have parting with what they have and giving it to the have-nots in the hope that they sort themselves out.
So actually, it's not really about giving anything. In fact, the dominant narrative that we have is that the best way to help eradicate poverty and increase development in the South is through charity and aid. But my argument is that this basically obscures what's really going on here, right? Because the charity narrative makes it seem as though rich nations have accumulated kind of according to their own brilliance and they're sort of benevolently giving to poorer nations. But in reality, what's going on is that the system has been designed effectively through the way the debt system works, the way the finance system works, the way the international trade system works, the way that global governance institutions are constructed in a manner that serves the interests of a handful of rich nations at the expense of most of the rest of the world. And so what I argue is that what we need to do, instead of thinking about charity, is thinking about how to fundamentally restructure the global economic system to make it fairer, fundamentally fairer, for the majority in the first place, so that poverty is impossible and so that we don't need charity and aid in the first place at all.
Where do you start with this process of restructure? I mean, you mentioned the idea of GATT, the IMF, the World Bank being, you know, formed on good Keynesian principles, the collective good all being there. That on paper should enable countries and nations which don't have that vast, you know, accumulation of wealth to actually drag themselves upwards and then flourish.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that these key institutions of global economic governance, like the World Bank and the IMF, when they were founded in the 1940s, were founded on sort of progressive principles of solidarity in Keynesian economics. But when in the post-colonial decades, as poor nations were integrated into the system, then that happened on unequal terms. And so now if you look at voting power in the World Bank and the IMF, the United States has a veto. And the Global South, which has 85% of the world's population, has less than 50% of the vote in these institutions. So what you have effectively at the very highest level of global economic governance is a kind of apartheid, right, where decisions are monopolized by a handful of primarily rich white countries, while everybody else in the world has to kind of take what's handed down to them. And typically, those are not particularly in their interests. And so what I argue for is that we need to have democratization of these international economic institutions in the first place.
You speak of that on a global thing, but let's look at the way that these countries that have already are structured. If you look at the growth of inequality in the United States, growth of inequality in the United Kingdom, these are problems that governments are unwilling to address even in their own backyard.
Yeah, absolutely. Although we're clearly seeing a lot of popular momentum seeking to force governments to redress some of these problems. And, you know, what's interesting is that this narrative that we have right now that globalization has caused quite a lot of inequality within nations like the US and the UK, but has basically helped poor nations catch up with rich nations. This narrative is actually fundamentally untrue. In fact, global inequality internationally, right, is actually has been getting worse just as it has within nations. And so that the real per capita income between rich nations and poor nations, the global south and the global north, has actually tripled in size since the 1960s and shows no sign of slowing down. So this narrative that we have of kind of convergence, the poor catching up to the rich, is actually not true at all on a global scale. And I think this is another reason why we have to fundamentally rethink how our international economic system distributes the wealth and resources of our planet.
It's all well and good restructuring the way that we go in that direction. However, when you look at the way that the world of work is changing, just look at, I'll refer straight back to the Western world. Nowadays, we're being told that in 30 years' time, we won't need people who do low-skill jobs. We won't need people who work in shops, who will check you into your hotel. The things that actually make people, give people the opportunity to economically empower themselves, those jobs aren't going to be around anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the arguments I make in The Divide is that one of the best ways to deal with global inequality is to have a kind of global minimum wage system. So right now, right, we have capitalism has been globalized, but the rules that protect people from the abuses of capitalism have not been. So we have minimum wages in rich nations, but we don't have a global minimum wage that prevents abuses around the system. But the problem here is that, exactly as you point out, as automation encroaches on our system, then particularly in the global south, we're going to see massive job losses in the coming decades, as many of the industries that are very big employers in the south are very easy to automate. And so, in this situation, it's not sufficient, actually, for us to remediate the problem with better wages. What we need is to start thinking about something like a global basic minimum income that can be financed by progressive taxes on global financial flows.
And finally, which countries are doing this well? Who's leading the way?
Well, there's some interesting examples out there. So we know that Costa Rica, for example, has a relatively low per capita income of about $10,000 per year, but actually succeeds marvelously on a lot of key development indicators, including having a better life expectancy than the United States, better happiness indicators than many northern European countries even. So we know that it's actually quite possible to ecologically efficiently produce excellent outcomes in terms of human well-being. And Costa Rica is a great example of that.
And that's Jason Hickel speaking to Emma Nelson. His book is called The Divide, A Brief Guide to Global Inequality and Its Solutions. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll take a look through the stories in the weekend's newspapers.
Stay one step ahead of the breaking news.
People are saying, look, enough is enough. The middle class is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. The rich are getting richer. And they're saying, look, this is not a fair game.
Hear industry-leading insights from our experts.
When tech companies have problems, they can go south very quickly. BlackBerry, Nokia, nowhere near the companies they used to be, but both were invincible. Nokia boasted that they were one of the first companies on the planet to sell 1 billion of their products.
And catch up with Monocle's Bureau around the world. Every weekday at noon London time, keep your appointment with The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Time now to take a look through the weekend's newspapers with my guest in the studio. Vincent McAvinney is the UK correspondent of Euronews NBC. Vincent, thank you for coming in
this morning.
Particularly as you're basically travelling up and down the country at the moment because it's conference season.
That's right, it is conference season. I was in Liverpool this week for Labour Party conference, and after this show I'll be going up to Birmingham for the Conservative Party conference, which is the final one. So it does feel like a bit of a slog. It feels like Freshers' Week once again because it's little sleep, long hours, heavy drinking, all that kind of stuff. But it's been fascinating this year. It's generally felt like an interesting conference season because we have now this clock ticking. 6 months today, the UK will have Brexited. So that really is dominating this conference season.
And you say it led to a lot of conversation about the Labour Party's approach to Brexit. We'll talk about that in a moment. But let's look forward to the Conservatives, because the front page of particularly the Sunday Times this morning, we mentioned this at the start of the programme, is saying that it's apparently now it's war between Boris Johnson and Theresa May. Beforehand was all sweetness and light.
Yeah, beforehand it was all, you know, the negotiations between the two of them, apparently, and this is now, war. The sort of stark faces here, Boris Johnson versus Theresa May. This sets up the next couple of days because Boris Johnson has decided. He resigned after David Davis resigned, so he couldn't sort of take the high ground. He was surprised by Davis resigning, so then he resigned. He then has laid somewhat low over the summer. We thought that he was going to make a move at one point in the summer where he sat in the Commons and was going to make a statement on what the Prime Minister had been discussing in kind of August time. But then he didn't really sort of say anything. He pulled his punches. He's kept low. And then he's kind of had this sort of revelation come out about his personal life, many of which had been published before. His wife and him were breaking up. And now that that is cleared, he is making his real move at party conference. And this is very abundantly Boris Johnson trying to take Theresa May's job. He has written a 4,000-word article in Friday's Telegraph. Now he's given this interview to the Sunday Times with their excellent political editor, Tim Shipman, in which he says, "Chuck checkers, I've got a new plan. I'm the person to lead us through it." The Prime Minister, without calling for her to directly go, he says, "The Prime Minister that handles Brexit needs to be a Brexiteer, and I was one." Oh, OK, Boris, so you're saying you want to replace her. And then, usual Boris, scrap HS2, build a bridge to Ireland, which is, you know, he tried to build a garden.
Building bridges, doesn't he?
He likes any big infrastructure project that can be called Boris something. Boris bikes, Boris Airport, Island. Boris Island, Boris Garden Bridge, now Boris Bridge to Ireland. He's talking about scrapping HS2, and he will go to conference today, and it will basically be a tale of two conferences, because the Prime Minister is right now talking to Andrew Marr. She makes her big speech on Wednesday, but on Tuesday night, Boris will get the jump on her because he's making a rival big speech. And through the summer, the strategy in number 10 was get into the summer recess, then she's safe, then we try and work everything out. They did all those trips abroad to try to convince EU leaders. And whilst they've been in the conference season for 3 weeks, Parliament is again in recess. As soon as they're out of recess, Boris Johnson could try to make a move on the Prime Minister, because he needs to get 48 Conservative MPs, which he seems to almost have, to submit letters of no confidence to the party chairman. And then that triggers a leadership election. But the real question is, does Boris then have 158 of his fellow MPs to back him to replace Theresa May? And that really is not certain. And I think over the next couple of days, Boris Johnson will be frantically working the conference to try to see whether he's got that level of support or not, whether or not
because
he can move.
One of the problems Boris Johnson has come up against in the past is that, as popular as he is with the activists, a lot of the MPs don't like him.
There are MPs that say they would resign Heidi Alexander if he was the leader of the party. Because, you know, Boris Johnson was off for a couple of years as mayor of London. He didn't really interact with that many of the MPs from the 2010 intake, from the 2015 intake when he went back in. He was apparently not very involved with them as well. And, 2017 election, more MPs come in and some went. And really the sort of talk among Conservatives is that a lot of them don't know him, and they think of him as a strange figure who is very much out for themselves. And they don't think at the moment that Theresa May's team's bet is that they don't think that he's got 158 supporters. And really, in what he's published over the last couple of days, it either shows that he hasn't been listening to what Brussels has been saying, and he hasn't also got a good grasp. I think what the Brexit process has shown is he doesn't have a good grasp of the Northern Ireland situation. Multiple Conservative Party members, Ian Duncan-Smith, for instance, and the former Northern Ireland Secretary, Karen Brady, who admitted in an interview that when she got the job of Northern Ireland Secretary earlier in the year, she didn't know what Unionist and Republican meant and which way they voted. And it's really exposed at the heart of the Conservative Party that the Brexiteers particularly did not understand the situation of Northern Ireland within the United Kingdom, how precarious it could be, how dangerous
it is. Which is extraordinary.
Which is extraordinary given its recent living history. But it does make you look back at the 20th century and think, well, they were in power for most of the troubles. So if they didn't have basic understanding of it, or kind of a human feeling of what it's like to be in that situation and why people feel so passionate about it, then no wonder it didn't get solved for decades. Theresa May, out on the opposite side, also done an interview with Tim Shipman, saying that she's basically doing what Jeremy Corbyn was trying to do, not sort of talk just about Brexit. He was desperate to get away from that. But she's talking about other things now, about increasing the stamp duty on foreign buyers coming in, about creating a Festival of Britain to rival the Great Exhibition in 1851 in a couple of years' time. This is a woman who's trying to say, I've got plans for the next 5 years of my term, that she wants to stay in. She's trying to look not just as a Brexit negotiator, but a prime minister who's going to last.
This is the weird thing about Theresa May, isn't it? After the 2017 election, she apparently told Tory MPs she'd stay for as long as they wanted her to. Then she has, or people around her have given indications that, you know, she won't last that much longer after Brexit. But then every so often she says, I'm in it for the long haul. I've got all these plans, 2021, 22, that give every impression that she actually wants to fight the next election.
She does. She does seem to want to do that. She thinks, I think what's really interesting about Theresa May is still when she was asked last year by Ian Dale on LBC, how would you vote if a referendum was tomorrow? She wouldn't say. And that's because she is still a Remainer who thinks that it's her job to deliver Brexit because that's what the British people voted. And with the whole question of the second referendum, what would be so interesting is if it did, you know, she is the one that will say yes or no to it. But it's because she is saying no in part because if there was a second referendum, she would vote Brexit. She would vote to remain. She wouldn't be campaigning for Brexit. That's she's admitted that already, that she won't say which way, and that's because she is still a Remainer, because she is very much now giving her MPs a binary choice and saying, if you don't back me, the whole question of Brexiting is now up for grabs, because Labour have supported the second referendum, including the option of remain. Chequers is the only plan that will work. Wake up to the realities of the world. And, you know, she's going to this week, I think, make an attack on Boris Johnson. She'll have to directly attack him as, you know, being, you know, a bit fraudulent when the claims that he made during the referendum and in his latest plans, because we already know that much of what he's saying, Brussels would simply reject. But as usual, Boris Johnson thinks his gusto and words will just get him over the line.
Well, that's the Tory conference, which said that's drama to play in the
one
next.
One more thing as well. The conference has already got off to a disastrous start because the party is facing a huge fine from the Data Commissioner. Because so last week I got my conference pass sent through, and at the front of the box was like, download the app, it's got everything you need, all these features. And I thought, I'll do that next weekend when I'm getting the train or whatever. I'm glad I didn't, because the app, which was downloaded by journalists, attendees and members of the government and MPs, had a massive data flaw in which you could access everyone's personal data, including their private mobile phone number, and you could simply use their email address to log in as them. So the Sunday Times journalists have taken Philip Hammond's email address, which is public because it's MP's one, logged into the app, changed some of it, put a picture of Eeyore as his picture because that is his nickname from the Winnie the Pooh books. So that is so because of this, now they had to shut down the app last night and they're now facing a huge fine. So off to a great start. And it makes me laugh because the current culture secretary had inherited this plan from the previous Matt Hancock, from the previous secretary Matt Hancock, who's obsessed with technology. He's a bit like
he's got his own app, hasn't he?
He's got his own app. Yeah, it's a bit like the thick of it. I call App Britain, and he had come up with this plan to appear by hologram at the conference to give his speech, which just has disaster written all over it. Think about Theresa May last year with the magnetic letters falling down, her voice going, everything. You just think, let's do this as safely as possible. And so the current culture secretary was that they were trying to, Matt Hancock was still trying to convince him, no, do this, it'll be great. And that was scrapped on Friday as absolutely not, we're not doing this.
It's extraordinary it got that far down the line. Yeah. Let's cross to the United States now, because a lot of coverage responding to the events of the hearings around Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, lots of coverage of this in all the papers, and I'm really I really like the Observer's coverage actually this weekend. There's two things. They've spoken to the it was an extraordinary, I watched it for hours. I really couldn't stop watching it.
It was one of those things you think, I'll just watch this for 5 minutes, and then 3 hours later you're still there.
I obviously wasn't old enough to watch the O.J. Simpson trial at the time, but it felt to me like this is a kind of moment that you'll remember in that kind of setting of something to do with justice. And it was incredible. And when, you know, Dr. Ford finished, you were like, well, he's done for. And then he came in and gave this, uncomfortable to watch, but it was a tour de force. You might not agree with the content. Amazingly parodied overnight by Matt Damon on Saturday Night Live, which I would encourage anyone to watch because it was a perfect sketch that they've done of it. But afterwards, then there was more drama on the Friday when One of the senators that was in there, Flake, was confronted by two women who had been victims of sexual abuse, who blocked the lift door. And it's an incredible 4-minute piece of video where they just directly challenge him. And he just keeps saying, thank you. And he won't look them in the eye. And they demand that he looks them in the eye. And when he eventually does, you can see he's just aghast by this. He then went to the Democratic senators and said, I can't go through with this. It's tearing up the Senate and the country apart. I want an FBI investigation. And that confrontation by those two brave women who the Observer has interviewed is the reason that now it's delayed again for another week whilst the FBI investigates. And the Observer have also gone to Yale. Brett Kavanaugh was very keen to tell you all about his CV. Very keen. I went to Yale.
To talk out the clock exactly. By just giving you a CV.
Exactly. Well, I think it was more just, it was the whole thing is a microcosm of privilege and male, entitlement, especially that kind of American Ivy League white heterosexual male entitlement. I went to Yale. It's the best law school country in the world. It was about how much he deserved this, is what he was saying. And they've gone to Yale here, and they talk about how there has been a culture of sexual assault. They go into the fact that the Delta Kappa Epsilon, which is the fraternity that he was a member of, was shut down in 2011 and banned for 5 years. For chanting outside a woman's clinic, no means yes, yes means anal.
And
it's subsequently, it's again under investigation after reports now reopened, but it's again under investigation after reports of more than a dozen sexual assault allegations on more than a dozen members. And you just think the culture now is still like this. The culture then,
30 odd years ago,
must have been quite something. And you just look at him and you think, is any job worth this?
But also from watching, I don't know what you thought from watching it, but Brett Kavanaugh comes across as somebody, struck me, comes across as somebody who, whether or not he is guilty or innocent of the specific things he has been accused of, comes across, as you say, as horrendously entitled.
Yes.
Very, very, very angry, yes. Argumentative, and very clearly politically biased.
Oh, absolutely. Like a total political hack. The moment where he says this is the Clintons' revenge, that was fascinating. Because when you look back at the history, he has only done political jobs. Yes, he's been a judge recently, but he was very, he was in multiple Republican White Houses. He was part of the Ken Starr prosecution of the Clintons. He is a political appointee, definitely. He is not the person. I mean, I've sat in many courtrooms covering cases, and I've never seen a judge acting the way that he did, and firing the questions, when he was asked about had he ever blacked out from drinking, and he just shot back to the senator, have you ever blacked out? Like, he was aggressive. It was not a temperament that you'd expect. And if you were before his court, having seen that, you wouldn't really think that he was someone to...
It seemed extraordinary to think
judgment,
that...
clear-minded judgment.
You would do that. People were saying, oh, it's a tour de force. It's a really impressive performance. He's done really well. But... he doesn't exactly look like a calm and temperate jurist, does
no.
he?
And I think what was really interesting was that many people came away from it just, after the Ford thing, I was like, right, well, that's how can anyone follow that? And then he did. And I think what a lot of people have said is this is a case of both people believing they were true, believing what they're saying is true, but actually one of them is wrong because perhaps he wasn't in a state to properly know what was going on.
It's a phrase, something and I've so, heard a few people say, yeah. is that they both, the reason he's so angry is he genuinely believes that he isn't guilty.
Yes.
Because, as some of the questions were leading to, he drank so much that he has absolutely no memory of it.
Because there does seem, his first year college roommate said he was constantly drunk and belligerent. And then this whole thing of the calendars, he's saying, I've noted down everything. It's like, who writes down, got drunk, who got wasted with my friends? And there was one date where it said, had some Ruskies, which is short for beers. And, it was remarkable.
Sounds like a charmer. Yeah. Vincent, we'll have to leave you there. Vincent McAvinney, thank you very much. Finally today, it started in a shipping container in 2015. Cricket, the restaurant, not the sport, is well known for seasonal twists on Indian dishes. It's now opening a new site in what used to be the BBC's television centre in West London. Well, the founders are chef Will Bowlby and front of house Rick Campbell. They spoke to Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who started by asking Will about the new site.
It's our biggest restaurant to date. It seats around 140 covers, 100 inside, got a large terrace outside facing the BBC building. The focus on the food, it's almost entirely new menu. There's a lot more larger plates. The focus is still on sharing. So we can accommodate all groups because of the size of the place. And it's, you know, it's the same concept, just a more varied menu.
And Rick, you've been working with Crooked, and I've asked you, how do you work in the one in Soho? But actually now you guys have to kind of move around to the three ones.
Sometimes we get to all three in a day. So we're really happy to be in the Television Centre. It's an iconic building in London and abroad. So it's a great project. It's going to be hopefully a new centre of gravity for West London. Some other great restaurants there, you know, underground cinemas and shopping and stuff. So yeah, it's a great project. The redevelopment in the area is fantastic and looking forward to things going forward.
Oh, that's amazing. And Will, just like to ask you, in terms of food, will there be anything different from the other crickets in this new one at the Television Centre?
I guess a little bit more variety. We've got a bigger kitchen. We've got 2 tandoor ovens as opposed to 1, so we can do kind of more breads. At the moment, this time of year, cook a lot of whole kind of game birds in there, whole fish, things like that. So whilst we still very much focus on our small sharing plates, we've got some larger items that are designed to be shared, so large joints of meat, large fish and game and whatever's around, really.
You guys are making me hungry. Eh? what about in terms of drink? Is there anything?
Yeah,
special?
I mean, we've always had to be with Soho and Brixton because of the size of them and just the offering there. We've always had to be quite disciplined on our drink side. With the Television Centre, because it's a little bit bigger and we have more space, we've got a much bigger wine list, which is exciting for not only the customers but for us. We've got all sorts of beers on draft and just a bigger offering in general, which is really exciting.
Do you guys think that, you know, to survive in the restaurant industry in London, you actually do need to have other outposts around town? What would you say about that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, if we just had Cricket Soho now, we'd still be surviving. So I just think you need a good product. You need to work really hard. You need a little bit of luck. You need to be disciplined with various things, you know. You need to be disciplined on the property or the lease that you sign and don't get carried away. You need to be disciplined on your menu offering and don't treat it as a vanity project. So it's a combination of all things. But no, you don't need more than one restaurant to be successful.
And you guys have a cookbook as well, right?
Yeah, we do, yeah.
When was that published, actually? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it was published in May this year.
Yeah.
I think Will wrote it over, like, 6 months from November last year, I think. So
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, long process, but came out in May, and you can get them in all the restaurants. It's a combination of our hard work, you know, Will's cooking, but also, like, our designer's work, the photography that we've had done over the last few years, and it's all in one nice book.
Because that's the thing about cricket. I mean, you know, everything looks quite tasty, not only the food in some ways.
Yeah, it's about the experience now, you know. Food is obviously a part of that, but there's more things, you know.
And Will, in terms of your cooking, when did you decide, you know, that, you know, Indian cuisine would be your forte in a way?
When I lived there.
Oh, you lived there?
I lived there, yeah. So I knew nothing of Indian food before that, to be honest. So I moved out there, I worked there, and I fell in love with the food, and that was it.
Will Bowlby and Rick Campbell there speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's it for Sunday Brunch, produced and studio managed by George McDonough. Our researcher was Miriana Laclasta. We'll have a mixtape of highlights and past sessions of Midori House in just a moment. A new Monocle Weekly in an hour. The news headlines are next.